Good morning, you may be seated. First case on our calendar, 05-1678, State of Ohio versus Delano Hale. Ms. Rigby.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I would like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Watch your time there on the clock.
Thank you. Today I plan to focus on ineffective assistance of counsel, beginning at the penalty phase. Ineffective assistance of counsel claims are governed by the well-known standard under Strickland versus Washington. I would like to start with the errors in mitigation. Trial counsel was ineffective when they put Dr. Fabian on the stand, whose testimony was aggravating, not mitigating. Starting with the first prong of the Strickland inquiry, trial counsel were objectively unreasonable under the prevailing professional norms. Putting Dr. Fabian on the stand was so ineffective that prejudice can be demonstrated on the record. Hale's mitigation phase would have been better without Dr. Fabian's testimony. The evidence brought in through Dr. Fabian was overwhelmingly aggravating and prejudicial. He was put on the stand to talk about future dangerousness, and that's what he talked about the future danger that Hale would be to society and to the people around him if he was ever paroled. He testified that if Hale was paroled, he would more than likely reoffend again, a violent offense. He testified that there's a subpopulation on death row that have a second homicide offense in prison. He said with Hale, he sees a pattern of an upward spiral of escalating violence. He admitted that Hale could still pose a danger, even in prison. It would just be less likely because of security. He also agreed that the best indicator of future performance is the past. He described Hale as aggressive, impulsive, violent, and with antisocial attitudes. He testified that the burnout for violence is typically from about 35 to 40 years old, and Mr. Hale is already 37. Dr. Fabian then admitted that he could not predict to a reasonable degree of psychological certainty what an individual will do in the future regarding criminal behavior. And if the entire reason that Dr. Fabian was put on the stand was to argue future dangerousness, and he can't even make a psychological finding as to future dangerousness, this makes no logical sense to put him on the stand. The prejudicial effect is evidenced when the prosecutor used Dr. Fabian's testimony to advocate for death in his closing statement to the jury. Further, the trial court also specifically relied on Dr. Fabian's testimony in his sentencing opinion when he listed his reasons for why death is appropriate here. Dr. Fabian became an advocate for the state and not for the defense, and his testimony was aggravating and not mitigating. The trial court stated several things from Dr. Fabian's testimony in his trial court sentencing opinion. The trial court described Hale based on Dr. Fabian's testimony that Hale was aggressive, impulsive, and he had antisocial attitudes at two different times in his sentencing opinion. He also stated that Dr. Fabian said that Hale's coping skills were very poor due to substance abuse and poor impulse control. And he stated that Fabian admitted the defendant's past shows an increasing seriousness of offending and an increasing seriousness of violence. Because the trial court took this into consideration, you can assume that the jurors would have also taken this into account too. Further, there's a substantial likelihood that the jurors would have given Dr. Fabian's testimony great weight since he was declared an expert by the trial court and he was the defense expert that was put forward in this case.
Counsel, was there anything, I assume most of this damaging testimony came out in cross.
Yes.
Was there anything valuable to the defendant's cause that came out in direct?
The only thing that Dr. Fabian testified to that was mitigating at all was about Hale's sexual abuse that he suffered as a child and about Hale's substance abuse problems. And all of that was cumulative of Hale's sister's testimony. They had already testified to the fact that Hale was sexually abused as a child along with one of them when he was about 7 years old. And they had also testified that Hale abused alcohol heavily at times, especially after his mother's death, that he took very hard.
Ms. Rigby, wasn't it part of the testimony that Hale made a good adjustment to prison?
Part of the testimony, Dr. Fabian did bring in part of the, skipper evidence to say that he adjusted well in prison.
Now,
that's
all of
correct.
This testimony comes at the penalty phase of mm-hmm. the trial.
Mm-hmm.
So the determination for jurors then would be whether to recommend a penalty of death by lethal injection or some term of imprisonment.
Mm-hmm.
And by characterizing Hale as having all of the antisocial problems, development, academic, et cetera, and then indicating that he had made a good adjustment while in prison and had not acted out during that period, couldn't an argument be made that counsel were using an expert to suggest that perhaps a life sentence would be an appropriate punishment? And isn't that a fair reading of why the testimony from this expert wasn't aggravating, but was really mitigating toward seeking that life term as opposed to capital punishment?
Well, I have two different responses for that. And the one is that trial counsel were ineffective for putting him, Dr. Fabian on the stand, even with the skipper evidence that he could have brought in, because the skipper evidence could have been brought in by a records custodian or anyone else. And further, the main reason that this really isn't mitigating, it's still aggravating, is that because this Dr. Fabian had testified to Hale adapting in prison, the prosecutor was then able to bring in Hale's prior escape charge. He was able to bring in prior Hale's prior offenses, which in the trial phase, all that the jury knew was that Hale had spent 12 years in prison. They didn't know why, and they didn't know that his actual sentence was 12 to 25 years and that he was just paroled. And the trial counsel knew that the prosecutor was especially going to bring in the escape charge because the prosecutor had warned the defense counsel two different times on the record that they were going to bring this up on cross if they put Dr. Fabian on the stand and went into future dangerousness in prison. And so going into future dangerousness, which is not an aggravating circumstance in Ohio, and which is something that the prosecutor could have never delved into unless defense counsel brought it up, was completely ineffective, and it did prejudice Hale. According to State versus Brooks, it only takes one juror in Ohio to vote for a life sentence as opposed to a death sentence, and we'll never know exactly what kind of prejudicial effect Dr. Fabian had on the jury. But the jury definitely had reason to believe that Hale was a future danger, even in prison. And scaring the jurors into giving Hale a death sentence is not advocating for your client.
What would have been the effect of having no expert? Let's say all your experts say the same thing. This is the facts. This is what the reality is. And if you don't put an expert on, then you leave it fully in the hands of the prosecutor to bring out anything bad and with no ability to talk about any of the good, such as the adjustment in prison. So aren't we back to a different type of ineffective assistance of counsel argument if he had put no one on?
Well, what I would say to that is that the ABA guidelines do stress the importance of having a psychologist, but the context in which that importance is stressed is when investigating mitigation. And so trial counsel would have been ineffective in this case or any case for not at least engaging a psychologist because that's part of investigation. But trial counsel at that point in this case they threw Dr. Fabian up on the stand basically because he was engaged to talk about things that were only going to be hurtful for their client, and that's not using trial counsel judgment. And as soon as they found out that Dr. Fabian was going to testify to future dangerousness, even though he can't even testify to it to a reasonable psychological certainty, and after they knew what could come out on cross, there's no objectively reasonable reason for trial counsel to still put Dr. Fabian on the stand.
Doesn't the Strickland test that you alluded to earlier put the burden on you to demonstrate that the outcome would have been different?
Yes, Your Honor.
Where is the evidence that you have that we can find in the record that the outcome would have been different, so that, if I understand your argument, it's a two-part argument.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and
I'm asking you to address that second aspect of the Strickland test that you started with.
Yes, and prejudice can be determined on the face of the record here. There is a reasonable likelihood that the outcome would have been different had Fabian's testimony been excised from this transcript. There was still good mitigation brought on by Hale's sisters. They testified to the abuse that Hale suffered as a child in California. They testified to the fact that there was many physical fights in the home, and Hale witnessed a lot of physical fighting between his parents. They testified that Hale's father drank.
I guess I'm not asking you to recant to recount what is already contained in the record at the mitigation phase. I think his three sisters and Dr. Fabian testified. Your position is, if I understand it, it would have been better if they had no expert. And so the answer to Justice Stratton's question would be they should just have left his sisters and not put any expert on. That's what you're arguing?
That is true, yes. In this case, after they knew what Dr. Fabian was going to testify to, yes.
All right. So the argument you want to make to us is that counsel were ineffective because they put mitigation expert testimony on during the penalty phase. And then my question is, where in the record can I determine that the outcome would have been different had they done that?
Well, there's what I was trying to get at with going through the mitigation that was on the record through his sisters, and the fact that this was a weak case for death, even at the trial phase, because the trial court had already given instructions all the way down to self-defense in this case. So this wasn't a straightforward case even to begin with, that if you just basically take Dr. Fabian's testimony out of this transcript, there is a reasonable probability that one juror, and according to State versus Brooks, that's all it takes, is that one juror would have found that Hale deserved life instead of death.
Four gunshot wounds to the head, two of them contact wounds or within an inch, is not a death penalty case?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, the trial court found that there was sufficient evidence on the record to argue murder, voluntary manslaughter, and to also support an instruction, in self-defense. And so here there was adequate testimony and corroborating evidence even outside of Hale's statement.
Jury didn't find self-defense.
No, they did not. And we also have claims that go to that in our brief, that trial counsel undermined their entire defense case in that respect also.
Counsel, I'd like to take you to that part of it. What was the defense theory of what happened here, and what was the prosecution theory of what transacted in the murder, what transpired in the murder itself?
Well, the defense theory is encapsulated within Hale's statement that he was attacked by Mr. Green, that he was restrained, that he freed one hand, and that he did shoot Mr. Green four times.
Okay.
The state's theory, I believe, at least what the state argued in closing argument to the jury, is that Hale basically just walked up behind Green after, you know, getting him up to his hotel room somehow and shot him. But
with whose gun?
With his own gun. That was the prosecutor's theory, that Hale brought the gun to the room. But in the defense theory, I did leave that out, that it was that Hale reached for a gun inside Green's shoulder bag that he had brought to the crime scene.
Was that ever established conclusively one way or the other whose gun it was?
No, because the gun was never found. So they actually don't know exactly what the gun was, other than through Hale's statement that he said that it was a Derringer.
Did the prosecution offer any evidence of Hale's ownership of a gun?
Yes, they did. They offered his sister, LaShayla's testimony, to say that Hale had mentioned having a gun before. But as far as I can remember, no sister actually testified to the fact that they actually saw Hale with a gun or knew Hale had a gun.
Okay, and Green was found in a vacant room, right?
Yes.
Was he clothed or not?
No, he was not clothed. He was naked, found in that room. And that is corroborating evidence of Hale's statement, because Green was found naked under these garbage bags, yet he still had his jewelry on. And if the motive behind this crime was robbery, and we're not disputing that a robbery didn't happen here under the statutory definition, but the facts concerning the robbery support Hale's statement, and the fact that the robbery seems more like an afterthought, because like after he'd already been provoked and already killed Mr. Green because of it. There's also other corroborating testimony on the record to corroborate Hale's statement and his either self-defense claims or claims of a lesser included offense like provocation. And other things that were testified to was Johnny Smith's testimony, which corroborated the fact that Green had a prior sexual assault in his history. There is also the fact that Hale had broken down and started crying right before he actually started talking about his statement. And this was prompted by Detective Baird saying, well, come on, stop telling me that Green is a small white man. Like, I need to hear your side of the story. And he writes in his report that Hale then broke down into tears and started telling his version of the events. There is also other forensic evidence that corroborates Hale's statement, including the fact that that the four gunshot wounds were contact wounds. In his statement, they should be contact wounds, especially at least the first two. In his statement, he says he cocked the gun right by Green's ear and pulled the trigger twice. I mean, that's totally consistent with the coroner's testimony. And it's also the trajectory of the bullets is also consistent. Considering Hale's size versus Green's size, Hale is 5'6 and about 140 pounds. Green is 6'4, about 250 pounds. So Green towered over Hale. If Green was restraining Hale, had brought, you know, his head down to Hale's level, trying to attempt to rape him, basically, and Hale struggles free and pulls his Green's gun out of Green's bag, then the trajectory of the bullets should be lower, as opposed to if Green just if Hale straight across, as yeah. opposed to if Hale.
My recollection is the prosecution made something of the fact that Hale is right-handed, and his description of the events would have required to have him to have the gun in his left hand. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, the prosecutor did argue that because Green was shot on the right side of his head. So if thinking about two people facing one another, yes, that makes sense. But what if Green turned his head when Hale grabbed the gun that was behind him? I mean, there's really no way to say that while you're fighting, free yourself from restraint, and when you go to grab a gun, what exactly happened and where Green's head was at the time and how it was positioned. So it really doesn't refute Hale's statement.
Counsel, Hale never said that, oh, he turned his head during this whole thing. He didn't account for the activities that comport with what you're saying possibly could have happened. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
No, he didn't comport for Green turning his head or anything.
Right. So the record is based on what the experts testified to. Mm-hmm. And there's expert testimony that, well, let's back up. There was the statement from Mr. Hale that after the first shot, the victim still was coming towards him, correct?
Yes. Well, after the first two shots is what he said.
First two shots through the ear, mm-hmm. in the brain, which forensic experts have said would totally negate any action that would, on the victim's part, that would comport with the statement of Mr. Hale.
Mm-hmm.
You agree with that?
Yes, I agree that that was the testimony that came in, that he would have been totally incapacitated after the second shot.
Did the defense present any evidence that would negate that testimony or call that testimony into question, that two bullets into the brain would have incapacitated the victim to the point where he could not have done what the defendant said he did?
No, the defense counsel did not. I mean, we've raised that as a separate ineffective assistance claim, that they didn't try to seek out a crime scene expert in this case. But I guess the point is that we've also raised another claim, and this is what I was, I guess, alluding to with when I brought up ineffective assistance of counsel also at the trial phase, is that the fact that they elicited Baird's statements to Hale on cross-examination, and that Hale that Baird was the one who fed to Hale the story of self-defense that Hale then used in his statement. That was the thing that really undermined Hale's statement, not these other inconsistencies as you point to. Yes, there are inconsistencies with the statement, and I will not argue that there were not inconsistencies. But as I said before, there was lots of corroborating evidence to Hale's statement too. And trial counsel and one juror may have believed that this was provocation, that this was self-defense, if Hale's core statement was still true, meaning that he shot Green because Green attempted to rape him. And after Detective Baird testified that he was the one who fed this story to Hale, basically, I mean, what he testified to is that he gave Hale a straw to grab onto, and it worked. And that was extremely prejudicial to Hale, because no juror is going to believe his statement at that point. I mean, they're not going to believe that anything's true. They'll think that he just totally fabricated this entire statement. And it was defense counsel that elicited that testimony for absolutely no reason. It wasn't brought out on direct. It wasn't testified to at any other point. Defense counsel were the ones that brought this up with Detective Baird, and then defense counsel were the ones that argued it in closing argument, not the prosecution.
Say that again. Detective Baird did not testify as to what?
Detective Baird, on direct, testified to the basics of Hale's statement that the prosecutor wanted to bring out, that Hale confessed to murdering Green. But then after the prosecution sat down, the defense counsel stood up and said, "Isn't it true that you told Hale Green was possibly bisexual? And did you also tell him that it would be understandable that you would see him protecting himself from Mr. Green because of Mr. Green's size?" And to that, Detective Baird said, "What I said is that we have reason to believe that Mr. Green was possibly bisexual, and that if this was a case of self-defense, then it would be understandable if he felt Mr. Green had attacked him." And at that point, there was no reason to elicit that testimony from Detective Baird, because there's absolutely no indication on the record outside of that testimony that even happened. According to Detective Baird's report, he wrote down numerous things. I told Hale this, and Hale said this. I told Hale this, and Hale said this. But at this point in his statement, he says, I asked Hale to tell me his side of the story, and Hale broke down and told me that. And he never once says, you know, I told him I knew about Green, and I knew that this would be understandable if Green attacked you. And that, and defense counsel eliciting all of that on cross, destroyed any chance that Hale had at a self-defense or a provocation case in this case. Because the jury at that point was going to discount his entire statement, saying, oh, well, Detective Baird just told him, you know, Johnny Smith did have this prior sexual assault, but, you know, Detective Baird told him about it, so that's the reason Hale, you know, made it up in a statement. And so the defense undermined their own case at that point by bringing that in, when there was corroborating evidence all over the record of Hale's statement. And again, even if there were minor inconsistencies, the major thing that happened was trial counsel undermining their own client's statement. And that was their defense in this case.
They may have done some of that, but there was an element anyway of self-defense based on the comparative size of the victim and the defendant.
Yes.
Was there some evidence that the weapon was reloaded?
Yes, there. Hale says in his statement that
really
he
doesn't
reloaded.
Play into self-defense, does it?
Well,
after
even
you have
if
two
it doesn't,
contact wounds to the head, then you reload the weapon and fire two more into the head of the victim.
Well, again, as I guess
hard to have self-defense in that instance, isn't it?
No, I agree, and maybe the jury would not have ever believed Hale's self-defense claim because of what you just pointed out, but. I think that there's still an argument for provocation and for murder, which were other lesser includeds, that then at the point when trial counsel elicited this information from Detective Baird, he undercut those too, the fact that this could have been a provocation defense in this case, because Hale could have still been enraged when he reloaded the gun and shot it again. And his statement comports very much so with provocation. If there's no further questions, I would like to save my remaining time for rebuttal. But trial counsel's ineffectiveness must be looked at cumulatively under State versus Gondor. And here, trial counsel were ineffective in both phases of Hale's trial. This court should reverse and remand this case for a new trial or a new penalty phase. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rigby. Mr. Abkert.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, opposing counsel. John Epker on behalf of Appellee of the State of Ohio. We're asking for this court to affirm the conviction and death sentence in this case. I'll go in reverse order and address the facts of the crime as raised by Justice Pfeiffer, and then address the specific claim raised by my opposing counsel in her opening argument. As far as the guilt phase goes, the key portion of this case was what happened in that hotel room. The defendant never denied shooting the victim four times in the head. One glanced off, three went into the head. The question was always at trial, what happened in that hotel room? The defendant gave his statement, his defense basically through his statement, as counsel indicated, that he was acting in self-defense, that he was fending off an unwanted sexual advance. The state's theory was that this was a setup, a robbery, and that he had killed him execution style. I apologize for using demonstrative motions, but it's important to understand what Hale is trying to say and keep the perspective of where he's saying everyone's at in his version of the events. He's claiming that the victim is right in front of him and that he shoots him. The fact that, and he shoots him in the head, he's right-handed. The fact that the bullets are behind the right side, the right ear of the victim, absolutely belies his statement. If you think about it, if a person's facing somebody, he would have to have reached around for the bullets, the entry holes, to be where he claimed they were. Also, there's a number of other inconsistencies with his version of the events. The size of the defendant, of the victim, is relevant. He was much bigger than the defendant. But that can cut both ways. It can also be used to show that he was, you know, a bigger person, he was scared of him. But it can also show that if this person was gonna if Hale was going to kill the victim, he would have had to shoot him in the back of the head. If the victim was in front of him, coming at him aggressively, a 250-pound man compared to the small man that Hale was, he certainly wouldn't have been able to hold him off and shoot him in the manner that he did. So the size of the victim is relevant in this case.
Is it the state's view that the victim was lying on the bed and was shot from while someone was standing behind him?
Yes, that the victim was face down and his head was close to the headboard.
Does the autopsy protocol indicate the entrance wounds and
yes,
locate them?
The entrance wounds were behind the right ear of the...
All four of them?
Yes, I believe all four were. Not all four went in. One was a glancing blow, three went in. They weren't able to determine the order, if the first one glanced off or what the order was, which one went in or which one glanced off and which three went in. But that's relevant because under his statement, he claimed that he shot the victim twice. The victim was staggering and standing up and he's reloading. And as the victim stands up at the foot of the bed, he shoots him. There's a couple problems with that. First of all, the blood splatter evidence at the headboard belies his statement that the victim was shot at the foot of the bed. The victim's head was closer to the headboard, so that undercut his statement.
Does the autopsy protocol show they were contact wounds?
Yes, they were...
All four?
All four were either right up against it or within an inch or two, or two or three, I think, of the victim's head.
And the blood spatter is consistent that the victim's head was at the headboard,
exactly,
not at the foot of the bed.
Exactly. Just as he described, he's sitting basically at the foot of the bed, and the way the blood splatter was much closer to the headboard. So,
is the origin of the evidence of reloading the weapon after the first two shots were fired?
His statement. He says he reloaded and shot him twice. And that's crucial because he claimed that the victim was standing up. Now, what the coroner testified, now, what they couldn't testify as to the order of the four bullets, because remember, one glanced off, any one of the three that went in would have incapacitated the defendant. The testimony from the coroner was that the victim would not have been able to stand up. The victim would not have been able to rise up after one of these shots that entered. So Hale's statement is that he shoots him twice, and then he's getting up. Well, that it just doesn't comport with the forensic testimony that even if you assume that the first blow glanced off, and we don't even know that, but let's assume the first blow glanced off, the second shot is going to incapacitate the victim, and Hale won't be, and the murder won't occur in the way that Hale described it in his statement.
Counsel, what's the prosecutor's theory for why he was shot four times?
It's just an execution style murder that. He was a big guy, and I think he wanted to finish him off. I don't know precisely as far as the number of shots, but it's our theory. This was just a gruesome execution style murder with four shots to the back of the head. I think he wanted to, and I'm speculating on this, but I think he just wanted to ensure that he was dead. He was a bigger person than Hale.
And the defendant was found operating the victim's vehicle.
Yes. Oh yeah. He was using his credit card. He was in his vehicle when he was arrested. He was driving around in his SUV, using credit cards to buy the materials that he used to clean up the crime scene.
Counsel, I want to come to that. This gets to be a death case because
of the death specification was the murder and the commission of the aggravated robbery. So the ag robbery was the key to it being a death specification. Just that
so
one.
He murdered him in the commission of the robbery.
Correct.
So he murdered him so that he could use his credit card to go get cleaning supplies to clean up the mess.
Well, the state's theory that he was when he the state's theory was that he wanted to rob this person. That the state's theory was that he expected this person, a purported music producer, to have a lot of money. He expressed surprise in his statement that what kind of music producer doesn't have a lot of money. He seemed surprised that he didn't have that money.
How many, this murder occurred at the defendant's home, right?
No, it was in a hotel room, in a hotel room.
Who was living in that room?
It was, I'm not sure whose hotel room it was. I think it might have been the victim's, but actually, as you asked that, I'm not sure whose room it was.
Isn't it the other way around?
What did you say?
Wasn't it the perpetrator's room?
I think it was, but I don't want to misrepresent it. Okay.
So, how many robberies do you encounter? Cleveland's a big place. How many robberies do you encounter where the robbery victim comes to the home of the assailant, leaving out drug transactions because apparently they're in the drug, and the robbery victim gets himself totally undressed before he gets shot? Isn't that sort of an unusual fact pattern for a robbery?
Well, I don't know that he was undressed before he was shot. The bloody clothes were disposed of, so I don't think the evidence indicates.
The bloody clothes?
Mm-hmm,
Where did you find the bloody clothes?
They were disposed of by the defendant, but there was no indication.
That wasn't my question. Where were they found?
He had disposed of them. I'm not sure where. I think he had thrown them in a dumpster or disposed them somewhere. I'm not sure.
Were they found? That's my question.
I'm not sure if they were found or not.
Well, then we don't know if there were any bloody clothes at all, do we?
There were bloody. Well, the defendant, in his oral statement, talked about getting rid of the clothes and his cleaning up of the disposing of the gun and disposing of the clothes and that matter. But I think and I don't mean to.
I'm not trying to come to the robbery. What do you understand felony murder to be that can get you to a death case?
Well, the murder and the commission of a robbery.
Okay. So if there's a murderer, and I realize we've got some cases that I disagree with that stretches this a lot, but if there's a murder and then someone later decides, oh my goodness, I've got to clean up this mess, and uses the victim's credit card hours or a day later, that's still a murder in the commission of a robbery?
Absolutely. I think the law supports that. It absolutely supports that.
Our cases may support that.
Mm-hmm.
Does a fair reading of the statute support that?
I think it does. And absolutely. And I think this court was correct in its opinions where it allowed for that. You know, it's a sufficient aggravator to bring a murder into a.
So where's the first evidence of robbery? When did it occur?
Well, if I could back up, there was evidence that Hale was experiencing financial problems, that he had a financial.
No, point in time. Where does the transaction, where's the first evidence of a transaction of robbery occur?
Well, in that.
In time frame from the murder.
In that hotel room, the only eyewitness to the case besides Mr. Hale is dead. So we don't have any eyewitnesses to exactly the timing of what happened. But we know a murder occurred, and we know items were taken from the victim. And counsel today conceded that a robbery took place. And in fact, in their brief, they argued that it was ineffective for them to even challenge the robbery aspect of this. It may not have been a traditional, give me all your money.
Hey, I just asked you a simple question. Sure. What evidence, point in time, you say the murder occurred approximately when?
When he shot him in the head?
No, day and time of day.
Oh, June 21st, and I'm not sure of the precise time of it. That time.
Okay. And when does he use the credit card?
Later.
How many?
In the time period after that. He was arrested on the 28th. He had been using the credit cards in the days after that, immediately afterwards.
When's the first use of the credit card?
The 22nd, 23rd, the body was found, I think 2 days later.
2 days later.
And he had already used the credit card for the materials.
Okay. I'm trying to be precise with you. How long after the murder did he first use the credit card?
That day.
Same day?
I think so, yes.
I don't think that's right.
But they were taken. They were part and parcel of that whole event. He's killed, and it's not like he killed him and then came back and got the stuff later. There was not like they were two distinct acts. They were part and parcel of the same act. He kills him and takes his car. He had been driving around with it the whole week afterwards. Clearly,
I understand that.
And it's not.
Well, counsel, is this a robbery gone wrong and the victim gets shot, or is the way the case was presented, he was lured to the hotel room for the purposes of killing him and stealing his valuables?
That was the state's theory.
I just gave you two. What one's the state's theory?
The state's theory is that he was lured into it. He had financial problems. He had lured him in. He expected this person to be a person with money. He was surprised that he didn't have money, and that was the motivation for him.
So he was executed so that would facilitate the robbery. There would be no resistance to taking his valuables that the perpetrator thought he had on him.
Exactly. This was a big person. He couldn't have just, beaten him up to get the money. He would have to have executed him.
Counsel, what jewelry was left on the victim?
I think so. Gold chains. I think some necklaces and just some gold. It was always described to me as gold jewelry.
So not everything was taken from the
room. Everything
was
taken. No, no, that's true. But items were taken, and so it fits as a robbery. And maybe it's not a traditional, stick them up, give me all your money, and now I'm going to shoot you. I mean, we just don't know what happened in there. But what we do know is sufficient. It's sufficient under the precedent from this court. He was killed, items were taken. And that's sufficient for to establish that this was a murder in the commission of an aggravated robbery.
Counsel, the appellant's testimony or argument here today was that the defense attorney was ineffective by bringing Dr. Fabian to the stand as a mitigation witness. What is your take on that?
I don't think the trial counsel was ineffective at all. Mr. Hale enjoyed the services of a number of attorneys, appellate attorneys, mitigation specialized attorneys, and they had a judgment call to make. And Dr. Fabian was their expert. And I agree with some of the questions or points raised by Justice Stratton that what were they supposed to do? If they wouldn't have presented any expert at all, I would be more afraid of that mitigation claim, ineffective claim on appeal, than this one. I think when they're given an expert, and he did present evidence that was germane to his defense or his theory at mitigation. His mitigation theory was that he would have adapted well to prison. They didn't get that in through any of the sisters. That comes in through Dr. Fabian. So Dr. Fabian's testimony was absolutely relevant. And Dr. Fabian acknowledged the portions that were hurtful to Mr. Hale's cases, his criminal record. He acknowledged that. But I think it still goes to the issue. He'd already been convicted. The question is it appropriate to execute this person or life in prison? And in that sense, their mitigation theory of adapting well in prison was an appropriate mitigation theory, and that's what Dr. Fabian talked about. So I think that while Dr. Fabian was only stuck with the facts that he had, and what's also important when you're dealing with an ineffective mitigation claim, this isn't a claim where trial counsel didn't investigate. They knew everything about it. It was just, that's a judgment call, whether or not to put up Fabian where there's stuff that can help him and stuff that can hurt him, or don't they? I think that's a judgment call, and I don't think it was ineffective at all for them to put up Dr. Fabian as their expert.
Mr. Epker, did I misunderstand? Did you say he had different counsel at the guilt phase from the penalty phase?
No, I'm sorry. If I misspoke. He enjoyed the services of a number of experienced attorneys that I think made an appropriate call from the County Public Defender's Office, including appellate attorneys. They were all involved in his case. They were all very experienced attorneys, is the point I wanted to make, and that I think they exercised their judgment very thoughtfully and very appropriately in deciding what mitigation to present in this case. Again, it would be speculation to claim, as the defense does, that had Dr. Fabian not testified, that the results of this trial would have been different. There's just nothing in the record to suggest that he only received the death penalty because of the testimony from Dr. Fabian. I think another point that's relevant regarding Dr. Fabian is when you look at Judge Ambrose's opinion, which I think is a very good and thorough explanation of his view of this case, nowhere does he discuss any of the bad stuff with Dr. Fabian as aggravators. He only looked through Dr. Fabian's testimony, as he should, for any potential mitigation that would have helped the defense. He wasn't looking through the testimony. He didn't use Dr. Fabian's testimony as an aggravator, which is can obviously be a problem in other capital cases. In this case, Judge Ambrose was very specific that just what the aggravating circumstance was, there was just one. And he looked at and compared any potential mitigation, and he culled through the mitigation from all the three sisters and Dr. Fabian, and really searched, and he gave some weight to what he felt was sufficient, and he explained his decision as to why that mitigation did not weigh the aggravating circumstance in this case. I think to turn back to the facts of the case, the one point that I'd like to find relevant from Judge Ambrose's opinion is, as we discussed here today, there's this question back and forth between what was actually what happened in that hotel room, Hale's version or the state's version. And I think it's worth noting that not only did the jury reject that defense's theory, but Judge Ambrose's opinion was very clear that he found defendant's account clearly untrustworthy, and he found the defendant's claim was false due to a lack of credible support. And he felt no doubt as to his version of what actually happened, or his belief as to what actually happened in that hotel room today. And I think that's important to consider.
What did the judge say his version was?
He found Hale's version as to this untrustworthy, and he agreed with the state's version that this was a robbery, that this was an aggravated robbery. He denied the Rule 29 on the case in chief and regarding the specification, and by his opinion, I think he accurately explains how he felt his view of the evidence was. And I think that's something that's unique about a capital case, in that you don't often get the trial judge who's sitting there listening to the case, listening to the witnesses, explain his view of it. So in addition to the jurors rejecting this defendant's claim, which obviously they did, Judge Ambrose very thoughtfully and very specifically explained his view about the evidence, what he felt was credible about the defendant's statement, the defendant's theory, and what was not credible about it. So I think that goes to the heart of the case at the trial level and what we've discussed.
Well, counsel, some of it seems implausible, and some of the state's theory to me seems implausible as well. I mean, if I had to guess, I would guess it was probably Hale's gun and not Green's gun that was used, since finding somebody else's gun in a bag and using it seems a bit implausible. Mm-hmm. But Green being there, wrapped up, buck naked, makes it seem like something else was going on other than robbery that started these events, and that more likely than not, use of the credit card and vehicle was something that this person did in a mad panic after the murder had occurred, which then leads me to something that I have trouble with, this court has rejected, and that is residual doubt as to whether or not this should be a death case. We're all required to independently weigh whether or not this is appropriate, and it just seems like on the sketchy facts that you have, this is a bad case to seek death.
Well, in response to that, I would say, and absolutely each one of the justices here today has to make their own independent view of it. But I think in doing your independent review of the facts of this case, it's worth noting how not only the 12 jurors that heard this, but the trial judge who heard this felt about the case. And we don't have an explanation from the jurors, but Judge Ambrose didn't feel this was a sketchy case, or he used the word no doubt, And
well, there's certainly no doubt that Hale killed Green and did with somebody's gun, his gun or Green's gun. There's no doubt about that, and there's no doubt that later on he went to the store and bought cleaning supplies and cigarettes and beer and used Green's car, and probably drove his car.
But I think what the point that Judge Ambrose made in specific, it's in paragraph 37 of his opinion, he said there was no doubt that the murder could have occurred as the way defendant described it. That's what he wasn't saying there's merely no doubt that a murder occurred and somebody took items and used them. He specifically said there's no doubt that the murder could have occurred as described by the defendant. And I think
But you require us to leap to there's no doubt that this was a felony murder. This was a murder for the purpose of robbery. That's the leap of faith that you're asking us to make.
Well, there's two separate things here. And I understand your questions about whether or not this was a felony murder. But the first question is, did the murder happen the way Hale did? And that's when I want to be spirit. He said there's no doubt that version is ridiculous. Okay, so he said there's no doubt about that. That's what I want to make clear about that. But also, I don't think it's a leap of faith to, or respectfully that I'm asking this court to make a huge leap of faith when there's no controverted testimony that he used the items and took items from the defendant, you know. And I don't think there has to be this sequential time frame. There's no case law that I'm aware of that about when you have to inform the intent to rob or this and that. I don't think that we...
I think that's a fair interpretation of our case law. Yes. I happen to disagree with it, sure. But I think that's a fair interpretation of it. But I think the nagging question is, what really got this all started? What really got Green to Hale's apartment? Did he lure him there with the prospect of sex for the purpose of robbery? That has to be the theory of your case. Is he got him, he knew this guy was an easy mark if he suggested, come over to my place and I'll let you fiddle around with me. And while all along knew he had the gun and planned to execute him and take his credit card, leave him go to the morgue with his jewelry on?
You know, I think the point that's always stuck with me about this case is the precise manner of the wounds, which aren't controverted. The four shots to the back of the head, to behind the ear. And that seems to me, I think I was asked earlier about the reason why there was a number. I don't know why there's a number, but those four shots right to the back of the head behind the ear just expressed to me a viciousness. I think prosecutors often use this colloquial phrase, you know, an execution-style murder. It does seem like that to me. I mean, it doesn't seem like this was some fending off defensive wounds. That's what's always struck me about this case, is this the gun to the back of the head, right behind the ear, and those four shots. That seems to me, when looking at whether this is, you know, some weird situation gone bad or a deliberate heinous crime that would bring someone into consider the ultimate penalty. And I think those wounds and the nature of those, the senselessness of it, and I think what was in the minds of everybody who handled this case, the jurors and the judge handling it, and I think they all took their jobs with much respect and seriousness. Judge Ambrose was fairly new to the bench at the time, and I remember this was going on. He was very cautious and. I thought he was very appropriate in the way he handled this case. And
I come back to the statute. We don't give the death penalty for even the most horrible, heinous type of execution if there isn't something else.
Absolutely, you're right.
So it's the something else.
There has to be the robbery.
Yeah.
Yes. And this court said, in you know, in Jakes and others in other cases, that you know, circumstantial evidence is just as weighty as direct evidence. We don't have any eyewitness testimony other than Hale's version of what happened as to what was going on in there. But you can look at the circumstances of a heinous, deliberate murder, not a happenstance murder, but a very deliberate murder, and a taking and using of the victim's items. Yes, he used them to clean up, but you know, he was using those items, and he had financial problems, and he's driving around. He just murdered somebody. He's driving around in his car. I think that's absolutely evidence of aggravated robbery, and it would support a capital specification. Yeah. I think I've getting close to the end of my time. The main issue raised by the defense was, or the appellate counsel today, was the ineffective mitigation, and I would submit there's nothing to support any speculation that the result would have been different had Dr. Fabian not testified. We're always on the look because we have to defend these cases when they're on appeal, and it's our interest to hope that trial counsel does a good job in these cases, because we're going to be defending the ineffective claims for years to come if a death sentence is issued. And I would be much more concerned if a defense counsel would not use their appointed expert at mitigation. Again, it's a judgment call. There's good and bad with Dr. Fabian. And these attorneys had to make that decision, and clearly the decision to put him on was not ineffective assistance of counsel. They wouldn't have had evidence to support their mitigation theory but for Dr. Fabian. And unfortunately, they had to deal with the bad evidence that came in too, but it was necessary for their mitigation theory. Thank you. Unless the court has any questions, we would ask that the death sentence be affirmed, and the conviction affirmed as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ebker. Ms. Rigby, you saved 3 minutes of your time.
Yes, thank you. This was a weak case for death, in that this was a weak case for robbery, as has been pointed out. And then Dr. Fabian did more bad than good at the mitigation phase. To respond directly to a couple of Justice Pfeiffer's questions, this was Hale's hotel room, this wasn't Green's, and the clothes were never found, so there's no determination on the record that these clothes were bloody or not. But again, this was a weak case from the beginning, and Hale did only take these credit cards, he left the jewelry, yet Green was naked, which doesn't really coincide with a robbery motive. And then he only used the credit cards for 3 days, and he wasn't arrested for 4 more days after that and had never touched the credit cards.
Does the robbery occur when the credit cards are taken from the victim, or does it occur when the credit cards are used?
To be honest, probably when it was taken from the victim. And according to the statute, we don't argue that this wasn't a robbery according to the statute in Ohio. We just submit that the motive here was not robbery, and that's demonstrated by the facts that Hale did not use these credit cards to go buy extravagant things. He lived in the victim's car, as opposed to, you know, buying a hotel room or anything like that.
I was going to say motive is not an issue here. I mean, we tell the jury, you do not consider motive, so why are you injecting that particular issue right now?
Well, it goes to either the self-defense or provocation claims. And if defense counsel has the affirmative duty to prove self-defense or that this was provocation, then that this is just evidence that supports that.
Counsel, didn't the victim get in trouble previously for unwanted sexual advances?
Yes.
And so we would have to believe that he was trying it again, unwanted sexual advances at the get-go.
Yes.
That he's in the motel room and didn't learn his lesson the first time and decided that he was going to rape Mr. Hale.
Yes. According to Hale's statement, that's what he said occurred, and he's the only one that was there. And even with the inconsistencies that were there, his statement was corroborated by a lot. And even self-defense aside, there was enough evidence that one juror may have believed that Hale was in this rage after being attacked by Green, and if this wasn't undermined by defense counsel's own doing on cross. And just to quickly talk about Dr. Fabian, he didn't fit into the appropriate mitigation theory that the state talked about. Dr. Fabian did not prove that Hale would adjust well to prison. He testified that Hale could actually reoffend in prison. And I see I'm out of time, so I would just ask that this court reverse and remand this case for a new sentencing.
Thank you, Ms. Rigby. The case is submitted. You will be advised of our opinion.